Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, my friends. Wow, that was interesting and stressful. We could not get into the show in any way, shape, or form for, 8 minutes, but I am now in. So that is good. Brian, do we have you here with us, first and foremost?
Yes, you do.
Excellent. I have no idea what that was about, although I did just read a note from the owner of Blog Talk Radio that recently they've been under denial of service attacks and suffering all kinds of ill effects as a result. He chose to see it as a sign that Blog Talk Radio has arrived. Because now they're under attack. Well, Teresa Argy, the world-famous haunted housewife, as I was speaking to her earlier today, she vomited 4 times in 1 phone call. So that's what's wrong with her. She has a really bad stomach problem. I guess the whole family's had it. She said their whole school's had it, the kids and everything. It's just been crazy go nuts. So we say, we hope you feel better, but hey, no need to join in as far as I'm concerned. We don't need a Ralph Fest right in the middle of America's Most Haunted. And incidentally, I am Eric Olson, and I am delighted to be here. All right, well, tonight, now that we're finally rolling, we're excited about it. We're talking about black-eyed kids. And, man, I've been seeing that term pop up everywhere. And obviously, it's fun to illustrate. You know, all you got to do is use your little Photoshop or whatever your editor is, photo editor, and put little black eyeballs on cute kids. I love the one with Macaulay Culkin from Home Alone. That was a good use of it. But it is no laughing matter to those who have been exposed in the real world to these very frightening little critters. And tonight we're talking with reporter Brian Bethel from Abilene, Texas. I forgot there was an Abilene, Texas. I know there's an Abilene, Kansas, but
people
I remember
there's an Abilene, Texas. Yes. So,
where is it exactly?
It's geographically, it's kind of heart of the state. It's close, about 150 miles to anywhere of true note, I guess.
Well, Texas is a big state, so if you're in the middle of it, that makes sense. So anyway, Brian's story, it really started this whole meme that has seems to be kind of cyclical and has come back around again. And Brian's encounter, I'm not going to give too much away, but it was way back in 1996. He just retold his story on the new show on Destination America called Monsters and Mysteries in America, which is actually quite a good show. And just to give a nice little short, scary quote from Brian's tale of his encounter, both boys stared at me with coal black eyes, the sort of eyes one sees these days on aliens or bargain basement vampires on late night television, soulless orbs like two great swaths of starless night. Wow, that's some good writing, Brian. Good thing you're a writer. That's why I'm excited about talking to you, because, you know, we have this extremely bizarre and vivid encounter experience, and you are just the articulate guy to tell the tale. So welcome to the show.
Well, thanks. It's never really done anything like this before, but already having fun. So let's looking forward to it.
Excellent. Well, I just watched the episode on, as I said, Monsters and Mysteries in America, and it's actually quite a good show. You know, there's a seemingly endless line of paranormal shows, and I'm always somewhat skeptical, or I suppose I have a higher bar for the recreation shows, but I think they're doing actually a pretty good job. And your segment, which was kind of interspersed, you talking here now in recently in real time being interviewed, telling your story with the recreation elements, and then a friend of yours was on too, I believe. And,
yes, my friend Chad Beavers, who was the first person I called after this thing happened to me. So,
well, rather than start in the middle or in the end or somewhere else, let's just go right to the beginning.
Sure.
And you do an exceptional job of it. Where I came across you in the first place was you wrote up your experience for your paper, and as you told the as you wrote it, the writing the story up for the paper was part of the deal for them letting you, I guess, or giving you the go ahead to go on the show and tell your tale. So why don't you just recount what happened? I mean, it's an amazing thing.
Well, it's interesting. I went by the movie theater where this kind of all went down today and snapped a few pictures. It's actually closed right now. The owners are on vacation. But every time I go there or drive by there, which is frequently, I still get this sort of chill that goes along with it. It's sort of interesting. The Monsters and Mysteries folks really kind of wanted to paint this as some sort of terminus of some sort of really ominous series of events or whatnot. But really, I mean, it was just a completely mundane errand, which I think is what makes it all the more kind of interesting and, to me, frightening, certainly, because I was going to pay a bill. I had moved to Abilene in 1995. To work for the newspaper, and this was sort of the early days of dial-up internet, and so I basically realized that I needed to pay my internet bill, otherwise it would get cut off, probably. And so I drove down to the movie theater because the internet company actually had its offices in that same sort of shopping area. And I knew that I could use the theater marquee to kind of help me write out my check. And then there was a drop box that I was going to put it in. And so it was already kind of dark. I think the sun was just sort of setting as all this happened, as I recall. And I was sitting there just filling out my check. And there was this knock at my driver's side window, and I looked out, and there were two little boys out there. I've said I don't really know what their ages are. I mean, somewhere between 9 and 13. It was kind of hard to tell. One of them was sort of hanging in the back, sort of this pale, red-headed little guy with some freckles. The one in the front was a little bit bolder acting, sort of this olive complexion, curly head of hair. And I just sort of, the first reaction I had is, okay, these kids are going to hit me up for money because, I don't know, I couldn't come up with any other reason for a bunch of kids to approach me, you know, after sunset, you know, outside of a movie theater. So anyway,
in Abilene, Texas.
Well, sure.
As opposed to Tijuana, you know, Tijuana, Meester. You want to try my sister? She's still a virgin.
No comment. Anyway, so yeah, I crack my window and I say, "Can I help you?" And the kid in the back never spoke. That's important to understand throughout this whole narrative. And anyway, the one in the front, who I've, in retellings of this, kind of tended to call the spokesman because he sort of had that air about him. He was this really sort of smooth, really too suave for a kid kind of character. I mean, children tend to be kind of halting whenever they talk to strangers and whatnot, and this kid was, I mean, it felt like patter almost. So anyway, he goes, "Hey, mister, We left our money home at our mom's house, and we need a ride to go get it so we can go watch the movie. Can you give us a ride?" And, you know, on the surface, this is just sort of a mundane happening. I mean, but there was something, even at that point, that unnerved me incredibly about the two of these kids. There was this fear response that just began almost immediately, and I had no explanation for it, but it began almost immediately when I began to talk to them and mounted throughout the experience. And so then anyway,
Let me interrupt. I just want to interrupt the flow, but I want to make sure that I really have the scene set. I think in the show, in the recreation, which of course you don't have any direct control over what they do, I think it showed the kids with hoods. Did they have hoods?
They were wearing hoodies. Yes, but they weren't over their heads, as kind of
okay.
depicted in the show. That's
just
one of those details. But
so you really could see them. You could see their heads and their faces.
Right. I mean, there was nothing obscuring their faces whatsoever. So
it wasn't like a monk kind of thing.
No.
And were they the same?
Made me a little bit more suspicious, probably. I would imagine
these hooded figures gliding across the parking lot. And were they about the same size and age, or was?
It looked like that the one who was doing most of the speaking was probably a year or two older, I would estimate.
Go ahead. I won't interrupt further. I'm sorry.
No. That's fine. So anyway. I start talking with them, and they sort of start explaining what it is that they want, and then there's this fear response, and I don't understand it, but it just keeps growing the more that I talk to them. And the rational part of my brain says that this is irrational. There's no reason to be afraid of these two children. You may be annoyed by them. You may not want to help them with their errand, or you know, or whatever. But there's no reason to be afraid of them. So anyway, the more I start talking to them, the more odd it becomes, because the spokesman then starts talking about, you know, he starts to become really reassuring. Now look, Mister, I mean, you know, this won't take long. You know, the house is really close by. Won't take any time at all. You know, and then he starts saying things that just are really unnerving to me. Like, you know, we're just a couple of little kids. we don't have a gun or anything, which is one thing that really, that really hits in my mind.
We don't have any bombs we're going to put at the end of the race.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, so, and the whole gun thing was really very strange, because there was this really subtly menacing undertone to that. I mean, it was just like, you know, we don't need a gun.
Right. Implied threat.
There was this brashness about it. And I'm sitting there just trying to understand why I am absolutely terrified of these two kids. And at one point in the conversation, I noticed that my hand is sort of strayed toward the lock where you would open the door. Yeah, I mean, and the lock, and I'm just sort of I don't remember doing that, so I moved my hand away. All this, long and the short of it. It took looking away from them and then looking back to figure out why I was so terrified. I looked up at the theater marquee and looked. I asked them which show they were planning to see, and they said Mortal Kombat, which kind of puts this in time in several unfortunate ways. But anyway, I look up at the theater marquee, and the last show of Mortal Kombat has started already. And by the time I take these kids anywhere, even in a town the size of Abilene, which is fairly small, by the time we get back, the show is going to be practically over. There's going to be no reason for them to even go into the movie theater to try to watch this. They may catch the last 20-odd minutes of it and some credits, and that's it. So I start to point this out, and I look back at them, and that's when I realize that these kids have black eyes and, you know, no discernible iris. It's all black. It's this huge, deep, black void staring back at me from their eye sockets, and I am just absolutely terrified at this point. I mean, I was scared to begin with. I didn't have anything dependent on. But then I look at, I look over and I see this, and your brain does multiple things at that point. I mean, it tries to say, how is this happening? Why didn't you notice this? I mean, it's multiple thoughts happening at the same time, but just culminating in this absolutely horrific experience of just utter, complete fear. And at this point, the fight or flight syndrome just kicks in completely, and I want to get away from these kids. And so I tell them, look, I don't think that I can help you. I'm sorry. I just realized I have to be somewhere. I don't even remember exactly what I said to them. It was just this babble.
My dog ate my homework.
Exactly. I mean, any excuse to get away. And I start to sort of roll up the window. And that's when the spokesman starts just absolutely slamming his hands against the glass. And I remember kind of glancing back at the one in the background, the other kid, and even with the solid black eyes, there's still this expression on his face. How is this happening? There was a look of genuine confusion on his face that this is not supposed to be happening. And as the kid starts slamming, the other kid starts slamming on the glass, I start to put the car in reverse and whatnot, and I will remember this for the rest of my life. The kid starts just absolutely screaming at me and says, "Mister, we can't come in your car unless you tell us it's okay. Let us in."
Mm. Man, oh man, oh man. I mean, it really does read like a really well-written horror story. Go ahead.
And at that point, I am in more panic than I probably have been in my entire life. I've had strange things happen before. I worked for at my college newspaper, the offices there were supposed to be haunted and all this sort of thing, and I had weird stuff happen. But this is an overt, in-your-face manifestation of something. I mean, at the time, you can't even begin to define what, but you just know that this is some sort of thing completely outside of your realm of normal experience. And now things appear to be turning violent and angry. So I slam my car into reverse, get out of the parking lot as quickly as I can. I have no idea how I didn't sideswipe 10 cars on the way out, because I was not paying attention to anything other than just getting onto the main road. I take a look back in my rearview mirror to see if they're chasing after me or whatever, and they're gone. And where they were in the parking lot, there's absolutely no way they could have run anywhere that quickly where I wouldn't have been able to at least see them standing there. They're just absolutely gone. And at that point, I floored at home. I pulled into my apartment's parking lot. I remember I didn't bother to lock the door. I literally ran from my car to my apartment, fumbled with my keys, opened the door, slammed the door, locked it, and just collapsed for a little while because there seemed nothing else to do. And then when I finally got my wits about me, I called my friend Chad, who was featured on the show, and basically told him what I had seen, and just because I felt like I had to talk to someone about it, and I knew that he would listen to me and not judge the experience. He would just listen and be a friend.
Hmm. Ooh. So. Well, it's stunning. And I can tell now, you know, even now when you tell it, that you know, you can kind of feel your I can feel your pulse picking up and your the level of tension, and it's it just had to be, like you said, it's like it's the injection of something so alien, and I do not mean necessarily alien in the sense of UFOs, but something
sure.
so, out of our normal realm, out of our plane, even, I suppose. And yet it was so intimate. I mean, here, think how close you were, when they're hitting on your window. I mean, you were literally inches away, and
exactly.
It's just, it's staggering. Have you had any experiences that you would deem paranormal since then?
I've been on a few odd, quote unquote, ghost hunts of the typical variety that's sort of popular now with
sure.
Friends and with for the newspaper and whatnot. And this is by far the apex of my
right.
paranormal experience. It's you may feel the occasional cold breeze in the allegedly haunted jail or whatever, but that stuff just sort of seems to pale when it's literally
sure.
knocking on your car window. So.
Exactly. So the big question is, I'm also interested in this because it's fascinating from a sort of a media sociological standpoint or cultural standpoint too. Why don't you just tell real quick kind of how this got distributed, and it really became, when I started looking you up, you were everywhere. You are the foundation story of Black Eyed Kids. Even to the point of them then being the acronym, the BEKs.
Right.
What is this story about? What are BEKs? When I read your story, because that was really my first exposure. And then, once I got into the story, I thought, yes, I've seen that phrase, Black Eyed Kids, from time to time. Hadn't really ever paid that much attention to it, until now. But anyway, so what happened in terms of how your story came to permeate the internet
right.
in those early days of
right.
1996?
Days of Yes. Back then, it was quite common for people to communicate on email lists. It's still a fairly common way
sure.
of communication. But I had joined my friend Lisa, who runs a website devoted to ghosts and whatnot. That's still, it's ghosts.org. It's still fairly prominent out there. Had this mailing list, and so I got on there, and people traded various stories and whatnot. And I'm a writer, and so I tend to sometimes even work through things just personally by writing about them.
Oh, exactly. I'm sure that's what it was. It helps to kind of set it down. It makes it real, and it gets it organized in your own brain when you have something so otherworldly and odd. I can't imagine you not writing it, I guess is what I'm saying, you being
sure.
a writer.
Sure. And so we were in I started writing it. I was in Austin for a computer-assisted reporting conference. And at that time, basically, there were just there were very few resources available to reporters. And so essentially we had a person up there telling us that the Internet could possibly be important to the way news is disseminated someday. And
how novel that was.
Yeah, that seemed to be a logical thing to me, and I felt like I wasn't really learning all that much. So I figured out that I could access my remote email through their computers there, and I thought, I've been meaning to write this up for some time, and so I started writing it there, finished it after I got home, and then posted it to the to the email list, and it sort of stayed kind of private on there for a little bit. But then it got posted to there was another common message board type in the past, essentially called Usenet. It's not really used anymore, but there was a group called alt.folklore.ghoststories, and it got posted onto there, and that's when it really just sort of exploded outward, and I started getting email after email after email from people asking me what these things were, what I thought about the experience, had I ever seen them again, et cetera, et cetera. And then from there, as the web especially began to proliferate, and it became easy to sort of share information with different sites and whatnot, it sort of just got passed around, basically. And even to
it's
this...
It's a classic early viral. It's an early viral. It's absolutely a classic kind of archetypal tale. Is Jason with us?
Yes, I am.
Are you cracking nuts on your phone?
No, but if you'd like for me to, I could. I'd be happy to.
Well, it just sounded squirrel-like activities after I brought you in. I didn't want you leaving. And we have. Is it? How do you pronounce your last name?
Offit.
Offit, just like it looks. Okay. So we have Jason Offit with us, and we asked him to join us as well, actually at Brian's suggestion. And he has done quite a lot of research into black-eyed kids and written extensively about them himself. And he's found lots of interesting stories that I was able to find. And just briefly, Jason is an author, quite prolific, Paranormal Missouri, What Lurks Beyond, Darkness Walks, Shadow People Among Us. That was all one book. Haunted Missouri, On Being Dad, Stretching His Wings and His Legs into Other Territory. The upcoming Through a Corn-Swept Land and a zombie novel, The Dead Earth. You can find Jason on fromtheshadows.blogspot.com and Mysterious Universe, where I saw several very interesting, very well-written stories of the paranormal, and in particular... Black Eyed Kids, welcome, Jason.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
My pleasure. And, of course, we have Brian with us, whom you know.
Yes, Brian, thanks for the plug, man.
No worries. I think this is actually the first time we've heard each other's voices, respectively, so hello.
Right, yeah, we've corresponded via email, but, yeah, this is the first voice communication.
Well, as I'm sure you've heard, Brian has kind of just wrapped up telling his amazing story, which I still find, I put myself in that situation. I picture myself sitting there. I could see myself doing every single one of those things, including going and paying an internet bill in 1996, and although not in Abilene, Texas, but nonetheless. I can picture every bit of it. I have my own story, and you know what? I think part of the reason this is resonating so much with me, I was going over my story in my head. Mine's even farther back, much farther back than yours. And my experience may have involved some kind of weird eyes. I'm not going to get into it right now. I'll be happy to say it in a little bit, but I don't want to kind of get us off track. But I'm thinking part of why this really struck me as deeply as it did is that I may feel a kinship in terms of the relationship. Now, so Jason, have you had an experience of this kind with black-eyed kids or are you more on the research side?
I'm more on the research side. I'm fascinated. I read the first I read of this was of course Brian's account online, and that absolutely fascinated me by the sheer creepiness of it, and trying to analyze why it scares people so much, why this fascinates people so much. I think the fact that they're kids mainly has a lot to do with it.
Well, A, absolutely right, because our perception, especially in the modern age, you know, it used to be, it's not that long ago that children did not have the benign sort of natural, innocent reputation that they have these days. It's really not that long ago that there were all kinds of odd, what we would view as odd superstitions and whatnot about children. And but nonetheless, you know, we have this view. I've read various places, kind of the modern view of children is somewhere maybe in the early 1800s. It started to kind of come together, the modern version of childhood. Anyway, that's another thing. There really wasn't this perception of childhood as a thing, as a specific period of life that entailed specific attributes and was supposed to unfold kind of slowly. You know, it was you grow up as quickly as possible. We get you up and functioning and working and being productive as quickly as possible. You know, for most of the history of, or much of the history of mankind. So I agree with you entirely that part of it is this extremely counterintuitive vision of children, and of course that's why films like The Omen or Children of the Corn, Orphan more recently, why part of why they're so creepy. But I think the other half of the story is the eyes element, because we do ascribe so much importance and such deep meaning to eyes, and whether we literally believe it or not, the cliche, you know, is on the tip of probably every English-speaking tongue that the eyes are the window to the soul. And if there's no window there, what does that mean? So that's my perception of why it's just so disturbing.
Right, and the eyes are the big question. I mean, the children part is, who doesn't want to help a kid who wants help? I mean, if they're in their mid to late teens, that's something different.
Right.
I've interviewed a number of people who've encountered children as young as seven, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. I mean, who doesn't want to help a kid like that in trouble? I interviewed a woman who had a kid about 8 years old, a little girl, blonde hair, greasy blonde hair, dressed in an old-fashioned dress, come to her door and knock on her door, and the woman opened the door, and a little girl was saying, "Somebody's chasing me. Please let me in, so you can please call the police." Who doesn't want to help that kid?
Right.
And then the woman saw the eyes, you know, of a rat or a shark, something. You know, she's completely black, and it of course scared the hell out of her. But the initial reaction, which is, I mean, whatever these things are, is to lull somebody into a sense of security and of pity by you know, appearing as a kid.
Brian, I wanted to ask you, at the time, but I didn't want to interrupt again, when you were talking, do you think, or do you remember, or do you have a sense, were the eyes the same the whole time, or did they literally change in that moment when you turned away?
You know, I've tried to work that out. All I can say is I didn't perceive anything out of the ordinary with them physically until I turned away. Whether or not it was there, and part of the fear was my mind trying to tell me to pay attention, or whether or not they literally changed in that moment, that's something that I've kind of tried to struggle with, and I've kicked around, honestly, because I think I would have noticed the black eyes initially if they had appeared to me that way, but then again, I don't know. You just, the brain also is adept at filling in details, and so there's always that question whether how they actually appeared in those first initial moments, and I'm willing to believe that my brain was perhaps filling in details that it expected to be there, and perhaps when I broke their gaze and turned away, it was sort of like hitting the reset button in a way in terms of my perception, and I saw things as they quote unquote really were. I really
well
don't
that
know.
Cognitive or perceptual dissonance could have been the source of your agitation from the beginning. I mean, you knew something was wrong from the very beginning, and it could have been tied to that you subconsciously were certainly aware that things were, that the details were really abnormal, but you just hadn't kind of zeroed in on it. Jason, with all the research you've done, as far as I could tell, there seems to be kind of this archetypal story. Would you tell that? Would you give us kind of the fundamental recurring keys?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is almost across the board exactly what happens in every case. It's pretty much just exactly as Brian laid out. I was listening earlier. Is someone is alone. 99% of the time it's from somebody being alone. They're approached by children anywhere from 7 years old to mid to late teens. The kids who approach them want something. They approach the person in a private place, either in somebody's house, their car, or on a street, at a time where there's not any traffic and late at night, and they ask for something. Would you give me a ride? Would you loan me some money? Would you let me inside to get a drink of water? Would you let me use your phone, please? I really need to call my mom and dad. Would you take me somewhere? And the person initially feels like they need to help, whether that be because they're kids and they just need to help kids, or if there's some sort of hypnosis going, because it seems in a lot of these cases that the person who encounters these black-eyed kids feels like they need to help them. And it's not a normal feeling. It's like they're compelled to help them. And then they look and they see the eyes of these kids, and they're, you know, completely black. No whites, no irises. It's just dark void, shark-like. And then they realize, holy crap, I'm dealing with something that's probably not human. And then they panic. Of course, they have to. That's generally what happens. A number of other things that are fairly typical for encounters is that the black-eyed kids are they seem older, a lot more mature. They speak in an adult tone. They're arrogant, commanding. They get more arrogant and commanding if a person refuses their request. They tend to dress in older clothes, a little bit out of date. I interviewed somebody from Pennsylvania recently within the last 4 months who encountered black-eyed kids in a parking garage, and they were dressed in brand-new clothing that this guy remembered was popular in the 80s. And it's not around anymore, but it was brand-new on these kids. They also tend to have bad breath and generally greasy hair and are fairly unkempt. That's generally the stereotype.
So how many stories, say, between the two of you? How many accounts that you more or less find genuine enough, or don't have any particular reason to not find genuine? How many encounters have you guys come across of this kind?
Well, I have gotten at least 200-300 encounters from people, not just across the United States, but Canada, Australia. One from Dubai, which was pretty interesting. That's quite a few, and one from an American in England, which was pretty interesting. But they seem to be the same about everywhere. But that's about as many as I've gotten.
And is this something that has been going on all along, or did Brian, you know, like, was he the little boy with his finger in the dike? I mean, did you let forth this flood, this plague upon the earth, Brian?
It's not my fault. No. Anyway, I have personally heard a few stories, and we're starting to hear more and more of these, I believe, that precede mine. Jason's probably the expert on this, but, I mean, it's just I've heard a couple from the 80s, I believe, and I think maybe this was in – wasn't this in your paper, something about someone's grandmother experiencing them or something like that?
It was, yeah, a grandma from Texas, yes.
Yeah, that one really intrigued me for many obvious reasons. So
the obvious question, which we have avoided thus far, what are these things? I mean, what are even the options of what they might be? Are we pretty sure some of the, or many, I should say, of your specifics sound corporeal? I mean, they sound physically real. They don't sound like they're phantoms. And yet, on the other hand, in Brian's case, they just vanished. Is that a common part of the tale, that they just kind of disappear when they're denied?
In a lot of cases, absolutely. That's generally it. When they're spurned and know they can't get in, or maybe someone else is coming. And there have been a lot of cases where a woman or a man have been home alone and they've encountered this, and they've called their husband or wife at work, and they're like, holy crap, look at what's going on. I got this going on here. I need help. And they're like, oh, the spouse says, I'm going to be home, you know, in a few minutes. They tend to disappear, or calling the police or something. When another party tends to be involved, they kind of vanish. I mentioned the man in Pennsylvania who was who encountered the black-eyed kids in the parking garage. As he was leaving, he the kids were begging to be let in because it was cold. It was in the middle of winter in Pennsylvania, and it was cold, and he tore out of there. He didn't want anything to do with those kids, and he ran into a stoplight, and it was like 1 o'clock in the morning, and then he looked, and those two children were standing on the street corner and started to walk across the street toward him, and he tore out again, and the same thing happened at the next street corner.
Oh, my Lord.
And
okay,
and
now that
as they
scared
started,
me.
And as he got to the third one, no, they weren't there, but still, they stopped following him. But
that's taking
the
nightmare one step further. Oh my God!
But
right, so
there have been cases of them just disappearing. Yes,
my daughter is sitting here listening because she read your story, your recent.
I got a
recent
question first. How old is she?
She's 13.
I'm judging you as a parent right now. Okay.
She's 13. And, yeah, it is late. She's been staying up very late with the excuse of homework.
Oh, it has nothing to do with the time. I'm talking subject matter.
Oh, yeah, no, she's tough. She's been watching the shows with me for years. She's tough. She's a toughie. She says, what do you think would have happened? Very good question. What do you think would have happened, Brian, had you given them a ride? And beyond that, has this happened to people? Have either of you run into anyone who did let them in?
I think that there are some alleged accounts out there of people who supposedly did, and maybe there's some. I've only kind of heard some vague things about potentially like bad luck or illness or, you know, doom and destruction following, et cetera, et cetera. But personally, I believe that this was a sort of a prey situation. I'm just going to describe it that way, because that's how I felt. I felt like that I had been deliberately singled out. And there was really no one else on the parking lot with me, sort of culled away from the herd, I guess, in a way. And I honestly do not believe that I would be alive if I had let them in. I believe that completely. I don't think that I would be here. I may be... I just don't believe that I would be among the living. What that might mean beyond that, I don't know. But I would be dead. I believe that.
Well, your instinct was so extreme, and your internal response was so strong that that would seem to be the only logical conclusion. I mean, the way you felt about it really from the beginning, it sounds like, and in kind of ratcheting up every step of the way, that certainly sounds like, you knew internally something, and you knew that this was absolutely a situation to be avoided. So, Jason, have you encountered people who have made the wrong move and let them in and lived to tell the tale? And then what do you guys both, what's your sense of what they are?
Well, yeah, the first question is, I got one story that I don't put a lot of credence in. A teenager, is about 15, contacts me. I generally, whenever somebody under 18 contacts me, I don't, I tell them I can't talk to them unless I have their parents' permission. But she sent me an email and claimed that she let one of these kids in, and all he did was sit in the kitchen. And then he just disappeared.
That's anticlimactic, isn't it?
Okay, yeah, that was like, thank you for telling me this story. I really appreciate it. but as to what they are, before I go into what they are, I had a reader suggest something to me once that really, really resonated with me. And she said, what if all of these cases of normally healthy people dying of natural causes in their home, what if they were the people who let the black-eyed kids in? Yeah, because you will read of 34-year-old people completely
right.
healthy, and they're dead. Just they're next morning they're dead.
And as you've said, a fundamental element of the story is that the people are alone. So, right. I mean, that's. We don't know what happened to these people. Well, that's interesting.
As to what they are, I wrote an article a couple of years ago for Nexus Magazine about black-eyed kids, and what I tried to do is to explore as many avenues as I could. And as far as how far back these things go, which you touched upon earlier, I talked with a Catholic – a Catholic exorcist, an expert in Islam, and an American Indian shaman about this. And these all people with eyes like that and behaviors like that have relevance in all these these belief systems. I also looked into and they're all bad, by the way. I also looked into health reasons, because people are born with physical defects with the eyes where there aren't irises or the pupils are very large, and there are also pharmacological agents that can cause the pupil to just blow up really large. And the thing that I found is none of these things medically or genetically can make a pupil cover the entire eye. It's absolutely not possible. One of the other things is people call this a hoax. And, occasionally I think maybe some black-eyed kid reports might be a hoax. But
sure, like
it's
anything.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's fairly far-fetched. I did some research on that. And the black contacts that you can buy they're out there. You can buy black contacts and appear as a black-eyed person. They're about $300 a pop per eye, and you have to have a prescription. I interviewed a guy who bought some just, you know, for fun on Halloween. Let's scare the hell out of some people. And he said there's no way in hell anybody under about, you know, 15 or 16 who could wear these because they're uncomfortable to put in and they pop out all the time. And that coupled with the fact that you need a prescription and they're that expensive, you know, what 10-year-old kid's going to be walking around with these scaring people?
Oh, I don't think many. Plus, they're relatively recent, I would imagine, too. As Brian said in his story, you know, this wasn't something that was nearly as common or prevalent just kind of within the culture. These days, you got the demons on Supernatural. Where else do we see black? The vampires on...
Vampires.
On True Blood and elsewhere. So, I mean, you see it in pop culture. And I imagine even back then, it's not as though it had never occurred to that point. But it's certainly much more prevalent now, and people are much more aware of it just because of the internet and cable. You know, it's not that long ago. You know, I'm old enough to remember when, you know, you only had a few channels and everyone was watching the same stuff. You know, it's only relatively recently that you had such variety, so many different shows and the kind of exposure, and then the social media / internet, the ability to talk about it and for all this word to spread. So I sure that possibly could account for X percentage in theory, but I agree it's pretty unlikely in the great majority of cases, and certainly the younger they are. And there's so many other oddities too. I find it fascinating that this commonality with the kind of the glibness and the kind of the adult aspect of it. I mean, so are you guys saying, I mean, are they demonic? Are they, here's what I've seen. Demonic.
Right.
They are literally demons themselves, or they have possessed people, children, and are living within them, a la the show Supernatural, something like that process. Then I've seen vampires, again, just kind of similarly to as you might see on True Blood or elsewhere. That, to me, seems much less likely,
right.
Because I'm not convinced that there are vampires. You know, I'm sure I'm in tune with the whole vampire movement. I understand the theories of psychic, you know, vampirism and that kind of thing. And, I mean, I can understand that. But, I mean, in terms of your classic blood-sucking, supernatural entity, eternal or extraordinarily long-lived, I'm probably not convinced that they exist. So beyond that,
there was
then,
a scientific study at one point about vampires, and if vampires appeared in the Middle Ages, and it was a mathematical progression, if everybody they bit turned to a vampire, we would have all, the human race would have disappeared in like 1648.
Right. I saw that too, and I agree. I mean, so even if it's, there's some, you know, variation of it that would allow for a much, much slower, you know, dispersal, it still strikes me as very unlikely. So then you have, I saw today, I read a story just today about that they could be, you know, what are broadly classified as fae. There's some form of fairy that they're in that line of succession that goes all the way back. These you know, entities that have always existed, kind of in parallel to mankind and have interacted, you know, periodically or do interact periodically. There's the trickster element. There's that. Then I guess there's what? Aliens. And then I guess there would be apparitions slash ghosts slash spirits. So what are each of your thoughts? And we can go a little bit over because we started later. While the live show does go off the air at 11, it is all still recorded. And the vast majority of our audience is always listening to the recording. So we can certainly go on another, you know, 5-10 minutes.
Sure. To me,
if that's okay with you.
That's totally fine with me. To me, this is the question I get asked all the time. What do I think they are? I don't believe particularly in alien-human hybrids. I don't believe in vampires of the supernatural sort that folklore would give us. I possibly could give some credence to demons. The thing that I'm actually most interested in, believe it or not, this does sort of fit the archetype, as you mentioned, of the fairy abduction type of thing. Carl Jung, of course, big into the collective unconscious, of course, he coined
me
that
term.
Too. And he said that the UFO abductions that people were experiencing were of the same archetype as the fairy abductions and whatnot. I do believe that it may have been something. I'm not necessarily going to call them fae per se, but I do believe that they were in some way corporeal, with also a supernatural element to them. Demons and fairy kind of fit the concept in my mind, I guess, a little bit easier. I mean, honestly, I've tried to really not – those are my two favorite theories, I guess, but I've really tried to not label them beyond just the fact that they were very strange, and I hope to never see them again. I mean, because unfortunately I have no definitive answers. Those are my favorite theories personally. The whole mysterious part about – they can't come in unless invited does seem to kind of come from vampire folklore, but to
right.
my understanding, that sort of thing is kind of a later vampires as medieval folks and whatnot understood them are very different than the sort of overly suave characters that we have on TV. That's more of a creation of Bram Stoker's portrayal of Dracula and that sort of thing. So to me, I guess basically there was a very primal sort of feeling to them as if they had been – I felt like also at some level, and this is something I don't really get a chance to discuss much, that I was facing something ancient, maybe something that was – that kind of had been honing this predatory instinct for a long, long time. And to me, I don't think that they are vampires. I know a lot of people give credence to the alien theory, but I tend to fall down more into the maybe fairies, maybe demons, don't really care, don't want to see them again kind of kind of camp.
Interesting. I probably am leaning toward your analysis as well. What do you think, Jason?
Well, the fae, the fairy explanation does make a lot of sense, and I've thought about that as well. The demonic angle. When it comes to vampires, Brian's absolutely right. The have to be invited into a house is a complete. You know, it's a modern thing. It's a Hollywood thing. It's a popular culture thing. That's not how vampires across the world have been depicted. They can come and get you whenever the hell they want to. As for the demonic part, that makes a little bit of sense to me when it comes to the needing permission to come in, because, you know, according to tradition, a demonic entity can't possess someone unless they're invited in some way. So if someone is demonically possessed and is trying to get to you, I would see that it might need permission to get in, to get into your house, your car, your, you know, wherever you are, your sleeping bag, whatever.
And that kind of underlies the fear and the concern about the Ouija boards and whatnot, that you're kind of unwittingly inviting them.
That's an entirely different discussion. I mean, I agree with your point, but I could go on about Ouija boards for the next 4 hours. So, yeah, please stop me now.
Okay, yeah, I was just inserting that one. You know, I do this show every week, so we talk about a lot of this stuff. But I mean, this is really interesting to me because it's typically the way the show works. I'm sure if you guys kind of look, you know, back through it, we kind of have the pair of celebrities on. You know, it's usually connected to a TV show, and usually it's an interview. You know, kind of it's more person oriented. So then we're discussing various things of interest and experiences that person has had in whatever their TV show is, and so on and so forth. So this is really fascinating, and my gosh, it's gone quickly, because now even with the making up for our lost first 8 or 9 minutes, we're already at the hour mark, which is quite astonishing to me. So, but, you know, this is one of the rare times we've kind of really focused on a topic versus, you know, so much the personality side of it, although obviously you guys are certainly both personalities as well. So I'm amazed by it. I will tell my story, and I'll try to do it really quickly. And mine doesn't exactly fit. There's actually one really key difference. But I guess what I'm relating to are some of these feelings that you had, Brian, in particular, because that is so similar. I was in college, so I'm old, so this was a long time ago, and this was in Springfield, Ohio, and in the 70s. And so my girlfriend and I did what we always did on the weekends, is stay up super late, you know, partying, doing this, doing that. I think we'd been to a party or something. Got up really late, you know, waking up in the afternoon kind of thing, and headed off to the pizza place that was kind of the less traveled because it was on the way opposite side of town. So there wouldn't be everyone there, and I'm sure we kind of had headaches and we're feeling a bit blurry and whatnot. But this was not a, like, really hardcore chronic hangover situation. It was just kind of typical, you know, wake up, oh, God, another late night. All right, so let's go get pizza. Are we alive yet? Are we awake yet? So we got in the car and headed, and it was basically one road pretty much the whole way, kind of a main city street all the way through town. And we were about halfway there when, out of the corner of my eye, my right eye, I'm heading, you know, I'm driving, I'm in the right lane. In the corner of my right eye, I see this small squat, I had the impression kind of middle-aged, but of course, remember, I was, you know, 18, 19, 20, whatever, at the time. So anyone over 30 might have looked old to me. But I had the impression, you know, not particularly young, and kind of dumpy and squattish and what you might call witchy-looking woman out of the corner of my eye. Latches on to my vision as if drawn, and here's this compulsion, maybe even this trance-like aspect to it, although this is all so fast because I'm driving, although I wasn't driving fast. I think we were just coming out of a stoplight, so, you know, maybe I was going 15, 20 miles an hour by then, and but it felt literally like a tractor beam, her eyes on mine. And so once I saw her, I kind of had to turn that way, and I'm turning back and forth, sort of never really breaking the gaze, or she never relinquishing the gaze, but I'm kind of still trying to look forward and see that I'm driving as well. Meanwhile, I notice just even more out of my peripheral vision that my girlfriend is doing the exact same thing and is staring at her. And in this brief period of time, this woman, this person, thing, ran out in front of the car and was heading right for the front of the car like a freaking kamikaze, staring at us both, latched, our eyes locked. And as she got closer, we could see she had this horrible grin, this bizarre, sick, rictus face. I learned that word when I was writing up the story for the first time. Rictus explained. It's look it up if you don't know that word. It's this hideous death grin on her face. And she was running right at us, right for the moving car. And I literally kind of just at the last possible second, the gaze, you know, the trance, the spell was somewhat broken. And I swerved, you know, like hard left, hard as I could. Pretty much. I'm just lucky there wasn't any cars coming the other way. And there was, it wasn't a divided road. And she still bounced off, literally bounced off the corner, that right corner, front corner of the car. And maybe even bounced another time, you know, a little bit further down the car. So she was really close to my girlfriend, the passenger side, really close. You know, maybe she hit the rearview mirror, or the side mirror, I should say. And we stared at each other just in horror. And, of course, I had to right the car back into the other lane. And then we stared at each other. And by then, I was barely moving. You know, I mean, I think I was still just kind of drifting on. We both, immediately after looking at each other, turned back, and she was gone. Utterly gone. This was a mortifying experience. We were shaking. We were incredibly fearful. We had both felt that sort of trance or hypnotic aspect, and that death wish or whatever it was, that she just came bounding. How could she move that fast? At us. And I took everything I had not to just literally run her over with that. And I honestly, I don't really remember what the eyes were. I don't remember. But this that smile, that grin was so evil and so crazed. And then, like I said, she was gone. And, you know, who knows? Could someone have run away in that time, have ducked behind something? I imagine, but it didn't seem like it was possible because it's a pretty broad road. And so that's my story. And the feelings that I have are very, very similar. You know, I felt this just total malicious, evil intent. And I don't know what she was. Obviously, she had physical reality because she bounced right off the freaking car. But
right.
It was so odd and so evil and strange, and it's one of those things where, and I've been reading, of course, about all this stuff, been working on this brand, America's Most Haunted, for about a year, and we've actually been working on our book, which I told Brian previously, we're selecting the 10 most haunted public or semi-public locations in the U.S. and then doing a fairly detailed, you know, 25 to 40, say, pages on each one, trying to go into more detail, not a whole book on each one, but really kind of get beneath the surface and try to figure out what's going on here, why this place, you know, what's the source, and so on and so forth. So, and then, of course, I do the Twitter every day, and we do this show. So, I mean, I've been immersing myself in the paranormal now for some time, and you know, you run across these kinds of things, but what I was going to say is, it's this experience, it's this feeling that people have that, and I've seen it equated just recently. There's been all this talk about near-death experiences because, what was it, a neuroscientist or something wrote that, wrote the book, you know, saying that, that was proof of heaven and all this kind of thing. And then, of course, all the neuroscientists are saying, you're insane! It's proof of, you know, synapses firing and misfiring and hallucinations and all this. But I really do identify with this feeling that experience is more real than reality. That felt so real to me. And it seems to me like, Brian, your experience felt so real to you that you can't, you can't question its fundamental reality. And while it the details are sound so odd, it's so fundamentally real to you nonetheless. And that's how I felt about that.
Yeah, it's really true. I mean, in that moment, there was also this sort of hyper awareness that sort of came over me. And part of it, I think, is that sort of fight or flight aspect to it. But I was as awake and aware at that point as I've ever been in my entire life. I know that, and I know exactly what I was seeing was real.
So. Right. And that's how I feel, too. So anyway, that's my kind of fundamental key paranormal experience. I had one other one in college. It's odd that people have told me it's probably a function of age, where you're much more open to these things until you're kind of firmly an adult, and then you, most of us anyway, kind of just learn how to tune it out. Because you just don't want to be distracted from real life, you know? Like, my God, I don't need this crap going on all the time. I had one other kind of similar, not in detail, but similar in feeling experience in college also. And, you know, those are kind of my two things. You know, they're that long ago. We're talking 30 years ago for me. And so I've held these feelings within me in this interest and this kind of sense of private knowledge ever since, but it's only recently that I've, you know, kind of got back into it from an intellectual standpoint and tried to, you know, really kind of figure it out. And look, I am a reporter, I am a writer, a lifelong, you know, a critic. I am scientifically inclined. I mean, I'm not particularly scientific. I'm not good at science, but I'm very interested in science, and I identify absolutely with the scientific method and sense of proof. But I also know that science just doesn't explain everything. There's just too much that science can't.
Well, it's not that it's just too much. It can't. It's with ghosts. That's what I've written a lot about. I've written a lot about ghosts. And you know, we've got all these ghost hunters going around with, you know, EMF meters and, you know, dowsing rods and whatever the hell they go around with, you know, trying to look for ghosts. And they're, you know, the question is, why don't scientists prove this? And I teach at a university, and some friends of mine are in the physics department, and they're like, we are ghost hunters. We like to do this. But you know what? We can never prove it. Because in order for science to prove something, it has to be repeatable. We have
right,
to be able
exactly.
to repeat it in the same situation over and over and over. So a lot of this paranormal stuff, we're probably, unless something huge happens, we're not going to be able to prove it. I mean, the biggest thing I think we'll be able to do is if, for some reason, we get our hands on a flying saucer or somebody, you know, like Harry and the Hendersons, somebody runs over a Bigfoot.
Right.
That's about it.
I agree. I'm of all the, you know, cryptids, I am inclined to think that the broad-based, you know, Bigfoot experience certainly seems plausible. There's big problems with it, though, you know, as we all know. I mean, we know what the problems are. Where's the frickin' body, you know? Why are they all so fuzzy? I find that, as a comedian said, I finally figured it out. Bigfoot is fuzzy. That's why, you know. So there's problems. But on the other hand, there's, you know, there's such a huge volume of human experience with them. And the same with ghosts. I mean, ghosts do not seem illogical to me. And I do think there may come a time, probably will come a time, when science itself will get a better, a deeper understanding of the various kinds of energy. And I think that someday we will, you know, at least get a tangential a quasi-scientific understanding of what this energy is and how it persists and how it can be attached to things and so on and so forth. I mean, we've learned so much just in the last, you know, I mean, my God, it seems like every week as far as, you know, quantum physics and now all this stuff with quantum entanglement. That to me seems very promising. The fact that they, because it's so counterintuitive. How can these particles on opposite ends of the freaking universe directly and almost, but not quite, instantaneously, they've, you know, they're saying there's a speed to it. I don't know, I saw it, what, 10,000 times faster than the speed of light, that they influence each other. And it doesn't matter where they are. So how does that happen? Well, it doesn't happen in anything close to our current understanding of matter and of cause and effect. I mean, it completely messes with cause and effect. So that is scientific, and there are objective scientific elements of that that have been proved. And there's scientists right now, you know, doing experiments with entangled photons, entangled particles, and they are seeing they, it is repeatable. You know, they are able to make them when one's positive, the other turns negative, and that kind of thing. So, and it's almost instantaneous, but again, not exactly. So, I do think we're going to learn more about energy and levels of energy and how the mind, you know, the fact that there is emotional energy or mental energy, and that is tangible and physical and eventually measurable. And I think that will somehow work its way into what we call ghosts. You know, on the physical side of it, I agree. I think it's most likely that we will at some point, you know, get some sort of evidence of Bigfoot versus the other cryptids. I'm not saying we will get evidence of Bigfoot. I'm saying versus lake monsters just don't make sense to me. How can they persist in such a closed environment? Because
but so many people have seen lake monsters. I mean, it could be something we're totally misidentifying. It could be anything in there. I mean, the giant eel... eel theory, you know, makes a lot of sense.
Well, and then you get to play with all kinds of stuff like the idea of quote unquote ultra terrestrials too. I mean, you know, people from not just other stars and places, but other dimensions, perhaps popping in from time to time.
Sure, sure, interdimensional, right?
That you mentioned.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, so there is at least a kind of quasi-scientific platform that you can plug these things, kind of all these things. Really, the only ones that don't really have kind of any sort of structure, physical, you know, platform or scaffolding was actually the word I was looking for in our scientific setting would be demons. And yet, from the religious standpoint, I mean, that's, you know, probably the most commonly held belief of all, I'm thinking, you know, in terms of all the main religions of the world have demons. You know, they all have demons. Christianity, Judaism, Hindu, Islam, they all have demons.
When I was doing my book on shadow people, I interviewed an expert on Buddhism about these entities, and he said, yes, we have these dark entities in Buddhism, but we don't like to talk about them, so I'm finished.
Well, and that's not uncommon either, you know. So it's really interesting. We had a really great talk. I was going to say something else. Anyway, about the we're already almost up to the hour and a half mark, so I imagine we can continue this in a later show, because obviously we're all interested in these various things, and that'd be great. I've had a great time talking to you both, and I appreciate it very much. But I was going to say, Ben Hansen from Factor Fakes, who's kind of typically associated most strongly with UFOs, he flat out said that he is leaning more and more as time goes on toward the interdimensional explanation for all these things, for everything, you know, ghosts, UFOs, Bigfoot. That is starting to make more sense to him now, the interdimensional or multidimensional
which I explored with a couple of different entities I've written about, but then again, all the stuff we're talking about, we're explaining something we don't know with something else we don't know. And yeah, I mean, it makes sense. Some of this stuff makes sense to me, but it's still not scientifically plausible. One of the plausible things is, let's get back to Bigfoot. The reason we don't have a Bigfoot body is hunters going in the woods. They hunt. Maybe the fact that Bigfoot is delicious is the fact that we don't have any bodies.
Maybe. I don't know. I'll tell you, I would not be surprised. I would not be surprised if there finally is some sort of actual objective, relatively indisputable, because, I mean, I guess anything can be disputed, physical evidence in my lifetime, say, for a Bigfoot type being, whether it be Yeti, you know, or our Bigfoot, or one of the other ones on one of the other continents, that wouldn't surprise me. On the other hand, it wouldn't surprise me if it never happens either. But then again, my answer to my flip flop, because I flip flop on all this stuff, that the only thing I'm fairly sure about is, you know, quote unquote ghosts. I'm pretty sure there's something there. It's just too common. It's just too universal. It doesn't really violate laws, you know, that I am religious, at least relatively. I mean, I have grown up with, and I've been a Lutheran my whole life, let's put it that way. So it does not, you know, there's no conflict there. If anything, there's support, from the religious side of it. And, you know, that doesn't mean there aren't all kinds of questions, obviously, but I am fairly certain, in my mind anyway, that, you know, there is something there regarding, you know, ghosts, spirits, apparitions, whatever. None of the rest of it. I just don't think there are UFOs. I just don't think so. I think there are, no question in my mind, there are aliens, alien life out there. You know, they keep finding all these exoplanets everywhere. It appears to be they're just common as dirt. You know, they're everywhere. There's trillions of them, literally trillions of them. So how can there not be? I mean, I will not be surprised if they find something, you know, some sort of microbes on Mars. That won't surprise me at all. But I just don't think we've been visited by these things. I realize there's so many reports. Just like, I mean, that can be your response to anything. My God, there are so many people, you know, in the history of the world who have reported encounters with that we would call ghosts. My God, there have been so many people who have encountered Bigfoot, and it's in, you know, every Native American and various other continents.
Every freaking continent on the planet.
I know, it's amazing.
Yeah,
it is. I agree. I mean, Bigfoot is the one to me that's so right down the middle. I mean, I really could see both sides of it. I've seen very well written, you know, kind of a little bit tongue in cheek, but very clever, very well written, you know, lists of all the reasons why that person does think it's likely that there is Bigfoot, and essentially identical lists of why someone else says there's not. And they both make sense to me. You know, there's plenty of really good points to both sides. Why is there no fossil record beyond the fact that why is there no kind of contemporary body? You know, why is there no fossil record? There's a fossil record of everything else. You know, why have we not found any of these things that are linked, you know, to us, to hominids, or at least to the great apes, anyway? You know, why is there no fossil record? That's so odd to me. You know, how can these enormous, huge-ass things rambling around, you know, stomping around, breaking trees and bellowing, I mean, how could we not have any, you know, evidence in terms of video or images, you know, that are not disputed? How do you guys feel about the Patterson, the Gimlin? What is it? I always forget what they're, you know, the 60s archetypal film.
Patterson Gimlin film.
Yes, that one.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
I'll just throw this out here. I mean, there's a huge collection of information out there that seems to suggest that a Bigfoot-like creature is a common thing throughout the world. So to me, this implies one of two things. It's either an actual entity, or it's an archetype that, for whatever reason, we collectively need.
You Jungian, you.
As people. But I've toyed with all kinds of ideas with that one myself, that it might be some sort of collective and passed down memory of our encounters with Neanderthal. I mean, all the way up to it's an actual Bigfoot. I mean, there's just so many possibilities. I'm willing to be open. I've actually wondered if the satellite technology that we have that's so useful and can pinpoint details just at an incredible depth of resolution. I mean, it seems like if we can have this global satellite image of the Earth, a snapshot of the Earth at any one point, and you can focusing on individual people and all of these sorts of things that they're supposed to be able to do. I mean, could you, in theory, find a Bigfoot that way? I have no idea. I mean, it's just kind of a...
Well, that's that blimp idea. You know, I mean, it certainly makes sense. Get a blimp out there that can, you know, be steered and theory will be silent and will, you know, that kind of eliminates some of the alibis. I don't know. Why don't we wrap with Jason? What are your Bigfoot thoughts?
I would like for Bigfoot to be real. I think that would be really fun. I've been captivated by Bigfoot ever since I was a little kid. But I mean, the thought of in the Pacific Northwest or someplace where there's a lot of woods, I can understand where something could stay hidden. But Bigfoot's been reported everywhere.
I know, it's nuts. I'm in Northeast Ohio.
No, the grass man.
You're in Missouri?
Yeah. You got the grass man. We got a Momo, the Missouri monster. Texas, it's huge. Oklahoma, I've interviewed a number of people in Oklahoma who've seen Bigfoot.
We had a Bigfoot sighting just 20 miles away or so from where I live in the 70s. It's strange. Yeah.
Well, my in-laws live in Paris, Texas, and they're Bigfoot reports there all the time.
Sure.
So, yeah, it could be. I mean, that's from if I were a betting person, which I'm not, you know, being a writer, I don't have any money. But being a if I were a betting person, I think Bigfoot would probably be the most provable in my lifetime, you know, paranormal entity or topic or however you want to phrase it.
I agree. It sounds like we have a lot of commonality here. Well, it is endlessly fascinating, and we've had quite a chat, and I really do appreciate it. I hope you guys had fun, and love to have you both back on, individually, collectively, separately, go into another topic, you know, as we did. And certainly, Jason, I know you've written about all kinds of other paranormal-type things in your various books, so we certainly could get into that, and I have enjoyed it very much. And Brian, I'm glad you survived your encounter tell the tale. And I very much enjoyed speaking with you. And I'm amazed, you know, amazed by it. It's one of those really, we've used the word archetypal, but it really is kind of one of those fundamental experiences. I don't think it's coincidental that it became such a meme and had such viral. It was so wildly viral even early on in the internet. So as we've said, Brian Bethel is a reporter. What's the name of your paper in Abilene?
The Abilene Reporter News.
And I know you're there on a ongoing and regular basis, and you can be contacted there. Jason, let's list your books again real quick. Paranormal Missouri, What Lurks Beyond, Darkness Walks, Shadow People Among Us, Haunted Missouri, On Being Dad, The Upcoming Through a Cornswept Land, and The Dead Earth Zombie Novel. And you, your work can be seen on From the Shadows, from-the-shadows.blogspot.com and mysteriousuniverse.org. Fascinating talk. Real pleasure speaking with you both, and wish you excellent evenings and henceforth in your journeys.
Right. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. All right. Thanks very much for having me on the show. And hey, Brian, good to finally actually hear your voice.
Same here.
All right. Good night, guys. Good night, everybody. Farewell.